played stiffly and badly, with many mistakes. She announced that she was feeling unwell and went to her room. In the guest room that night, William Stoner could not sleep. He stared up into the dark and wondered at the strangeness that had come over his life, and for the first time questioned the wisdom of what he was about to do. He thought of Edith and felt some reassurance. He supposed that all men were as uncertain as he suddenly had become, and had the same doubts. He had to catch an early train back to Columbia the next morning, so that he had little time after breakfast. He wanted to take a trolley to the station, but Mr. Bostwick insisted that one of the servants drive him in the landau. Edith was to write him in a few days about the wedding plans. He thanked the Bostwicks and bade them goodbye. They walked with him and Edith to the front door. He had almost reached the front gate when he heard footsteps running behind him. He turned. It was Edith. She stood very stiff and tall. Her face was pale, and she was looking straight at him. "I'll try to be a good wife to you, William," she said. "I'll try." He realized that it was the first time anyone had spoken his name since he had come there. Chapter 4. For reasons she would not explain, Edith did not want to be married in St. Louis, so the wedding was held in Columbia, in the large drawing room of Emma Darley, where they had spent their first hours together. It was the first week in February, just after classes were dismissed for the semester break. The Bostwicks took the train from St. Louis, and William's parents, who had not met Edith, drove down from the farm, arriving on Saturday afternoon, the day before the wedding. Stoner wanted to put them up at a hotel, but they preferred to stay with the Foots, even though the Foots had grown cold and distant since William had left their employ.
"Wouldn't know how to do in a hotel," his father said seriously. "And the Foots can put up with us for one night."
That evening William rented a gig and drove his parents into town to Emma Darley's house so that they could meet Edith. They were met at the door by Mrs. Darley, who gave William's parents a brief embarrassed glance and asked them into the parlor. His mother and father sat carefully, as if afraid to move in their stiff new clothes.
"I don't know what can be keeping Edith," Mrs. Darley murmured after a while. "If you'll excuse me."
She went out of the room to get her niece. After a long time Edith came down. She entered the parlor slowly, reluctantly, with a kind of frightened defiance. They rose to their feet, and for several moments the four of them stood awkwardly, not knowing what to say. Then Edith came forward stiffly and gave her hand, first to William's mother and then to his father.
"How do?"
his father said formally, and released her hand as if afraid it would break. Edith glanced at him, tried to smile, and backed away.
"Sit down," she said. "Please sit down."
They sat. William said something. His voice sounded strained to him. In a silence, quietly and wonderingly, as if she spoke her thoughts aloud, his mother said,
"My, she's a pretty thing, isn't she?"
William laughed a little and said gently, "Yes, ma'am, she is." They were able to speak more easily then, though they darted glances at each other and then looked away into the distances of the room. Edith murmured that she was glad to meet them, that she was sorry they hadn't met before.
"And when we get settled—"
She paused, and William wondered if she was going to continue.
"When we get settled, you must come to visit us."
"Thank you kindly," his mother said.
The talk went on, but it was interrupted by long silences. Edith's nervousness increased, became more apparent, and once or twice she did not respond to a question someone asked her. William got to his feet, and his mother, with a nervous look around her, stood also, but his father did not move. He looked directly at Edith and kept his eyes on her for a long time. Finally he said,
"William was always a good boy. I'm glad he's getting himself a fine woman. The man needs himself a woman to do for him and give him comfort. Now you be good to William. He ought to have someone who can be good to him."
Edith's head came back in a kind of reflex of shock. Her eyes were wide, and for a moment William thought she was angry, but she was not. His father and Edith looked at each other for a long time, and their eyes did not waver.
"I'll try, Mr. Stoner," Edith said. "I'll try."
Then his father got to his feet and bowed clumsily and said,
"It's getting late. We'd best be getting along."
And he walked with his wife, shapeless and dark and small beside him, to the door, leaving Edith and his son together. Edith did not speak to him, but when he turned to bid her good night, William saw that tears were swimming in her eyes. He bent to kiss her, and he felt the frail strength of her slender fingers on his arms. The cold, clear sunlight of the February afternoon slanted through the front windows of the Darley house and was broken by the figures that moved about in the large parlor. His parents stood curiously alone in a corner of the room. The Bostwicks, who had come in only an hour before on the morning train, stood near them, not looking at them. Gordon Finch walked heavily and anxiously around, as if he were in charge of something. There were a few people, friends of Edith or her parents, whom he did not know. He heard himself speaking to those about him, felt his lips smiling, and heard voices come to him as if muffled by layers of thick cloth. Gordon Finch was beside him. His face was sweaty, and it glowed above his dark suit. He grinned nervously.
"You about ready, Bill?"
Stoner felt his head nod.
Finch said, "Does the doomed man have any last requests?"
Stoner smiled and shook his head. Finch clapped him on the shoulder.
"You just stick by me. Do what I tell you. Everything's under control. Edith will be down in a few minutes."
He wondered if he would remember this after it was over. Everything seemed a blur, as if he saw through a haze. He heard himself ask Finch, "The minister, I haven't seen him. Is he here?" Finch laughed and shook his head and said something. Then a murmur came over the room. Edith was walking down the stairs. In her white dress, she was like a cold light coming into the room. Stoner started involuntarily toward her and felt Finch's hand on his arm, restraining him. Edith was pale, but she gave him a small smile. Then she was beside him, and they were walking together. A stranger with a round collar stood before them. He was short and fat, and he had a vague face. He was mumbling words and looking at a white book in his hands. William heard himself responding to silences. He felt Edith trembling beside him. Then there was a long silence, and another murmur, and the sound of laughter. Someone said, "Kiss the bride!" He felt himself turned. Finch was grinning at him. He smiled down at Edith, whose face swam before him, and kissed her. Her lips were as dry as his own. He felt his hand being pumped. People were clapping him on the back and laughing. The room was milling. New people came in the door. A large cut-glass bowl of punch seemed to have appeared on a long table at one end of the parlor. There was a cake. Someone held his and Edith's hands together. There was a knife. He understood that he was supposed to guide her hand as she cut the cake. Then he was separated from Edith and couldn't see her in the throng of people. He was talking and laughing, nodding and looking around the room to see if he could find Edith. He saw his mother and father standing in the same corner of the room from which they had not moved. His mother was smiling, and his father had his hand awkwardly on her shoulder. He started to go to them, but he could not break away from whoever was talking to him. Then he saw Edith. She was with her father and mother and her aunt. Her father, with a slight frown on his face, was surveying the room, as if impatient with it. And her mother was weeping, her eyes red and puffed above her heavy cheekbones, and her mouth pursed downward like a child's. Mrs. Darley and Edith had their arms about her. Mrs. Darley was talking to her rapidly, as if trying to explain something. But even across the room, William could see that Edith was silent. Her face was like a mask, expressionless and white. After a moment they led Mrs. Bostwick from the room, and William did not see Edith again until the reception was over, until Gordon Finch whispered something in his ear, led him to a side door that opened onto a little garden, and pushed him outside. Edith was waiting there, bundled against the cold, her collar turned up about her face so that he could not see it. Gordon Finch, laughing and saying words that William could not understand, hustled them down a path to the street, where a covered buggy was waiting to carry them to the station. It was not until they were on the train, which would take them to St. Louis for their week's honeymoon, that William Stoner realized that it was all over, and that he had a wife. They went into marriage innocent, but innocent in profoundly different ways. They were both virginal, and they were conscious of their inexperience, but whereas William, having been raised on a farm, took as unremarkable the natural processes of life, they were to Edith profoundly mysterious and unexpected. She knew nothing of them, and there was something within her which did not wish to know of them. And so, like many others, their honeymoon was a failure. Yet they would not admit this to themselves, and they did not realize the significance of the failure until long afterward. They arrived in St. Louis late Sunday night. On the train, surrounded by strangers who looked curiously and approvingly at them, Edith had been animated and almost gay. They laughed and held hands and spoke of the days to come. Once in the city, and by the time William had found a carriage to take them to their hotel, Edith's gaiety had become faintly hysterical. He half carried her, laughing, through the entrance of the Ambassador Hotel, a massive structure of brown-cut stone. The lobby was nearly deserted, dark and heavy like a cavern. When they got inside, Edith abruptly quieted and swayed uncertainly beside him as they walked across the immense floor to the desk. By the time they got to their room, she was nearly physically ill. She trembled as if in a fever, and her lips were blue against her chalk-like skin. William wanted to find her a doctor, but she insisted that she was only tired, that she needed rest. They spoke gravely of the strain of the day, and Edith hinted at some delicacy that troubled her from time to time. She murmured, but without looking at him and without intonation in her voice, that she wanted their first hours together to be perfect. And William said, "They are. They will be. You must rest. Our marriage will begin tomorrow." And like other new husbands of whom he had heard, and at whose expense he had at one time or another made jokes, he spent his wedding night apart from his wife, his long body curled stiffly and sleeplessly on a small sofa, his eyes open to the passing night. He awoke early. Their suite, arranged and paid for by Edith's parents as a wedding gift, was on the 10th floor, and it commanded a view of the city. He called softly to Edith, and in a few minutes she came out of the bedroom, tying the sash of her dressing gown, yawning sleepily, smiling a little. William felt his love for her grip his throat. He took her by the hand, and they stood before the window in their sitting room, looking down. Automobiles, pedestrians, and carriages crept on the narrow streets below them. They seemed to themselves far removed from the run of humanity and its pursuits. In the distance, visible beyond the square buildings of red brick and stone, the Mississippi River wound its bluish-brown length in the morning sun. The riverboats and tugs that crawled up and down its stiff bends were like toys, though their stacks gave off great quantities of gray smoke to the winter air. A sense of calm came over him. He put his arm around his wife and held her lightly, and they both gazed down upon a world that seemed full of promise and quiet adventure. They breakfasted early. Edith seemed refreshed, fully recovered from her indisposition of the night before. She was almost gay again, and she looked at William with an intimacy and warmth that he thought were from gratitude and love. They did not speak of the night before. Every now and then Edith looked at her new ring and adjusted it on her finger. They wrapped themselves against the cold and walked the St. Louis streets, which were just beginning to crowd with people. They looked at goods in windows, they spoke of the future, and gravely thought of how they would fill it. William began to regain the ease and fluency he had discovered during his early courtship of this woman, who had become his wife. Edith clung to his arm and seemed to attend to what he said as she had never done before. They had mid-morning coffee in a small warm shop and watched the passers-by scurry through the cold. They found a carriage and drove to the art museum. Arm in arm, they walked through the high rooms, through the rich glow of light reflected from the paintings. In the quietness, in the warmth, in the air that took on a timelessness from the old paintings and statuary, William Stoner felt an outrush of affection for the tall, delicate girl who walked beside him, and he felt a quiet passion rise within him, warm and formally sensuous, like the colors that came out from the walls around him. When they left there late in the afternoon, the sky had clouded and a thin drizzle had started, but William Stoner carried within him the warmth he had gathered in the museum. They got back to the hotel shortly after sunset. Edith went into the bedroom to rest, and William called downstairs to have a light dinner sent to their rooms, and on a sudden inspiration, he went downstairs himself into the saloon and asked for a bottle of champagne to be iced and sent up within the hour. The bartender nodded glumly and told him that it would not be a good champagne. By the 1st of July, prohibition would be national. Already it was illegal to brew or distill liquors, and there were no more than 50 bottles of champagne of any sort in the cellars of the hotel, and he would have to charge more than the champagne was worth. Stoner smiled and told him that would be all right. Although on special occasions of celebration in her parents' home, Edith had taken a little wine, she had never before tasted champagne. As they ate their dinner, set up on a small square table in their sitting room, she glanced nervously at the strange bottle in its bucket of ice. Two white candles in dull brass holders glowed unevenly against the darkness. William had turned out the other lights. The candles flickered between them as they talked, and the light caught the curves of the smooth dark bottle and glittered upon the ice that surrounded it. They were nervous and cautiously gay. Inexpertly he withdrew the cork from the champagne. Edith jumped at the loud report. White froth spurted from the bottleneck and drenched his hand. They laughed at his clumsiness. They drank a glass of the wine, and Edith pretended tipsiness. They drank another glass. William thought he saw a languor come over her, a quietness fall upon her face, a pensiveness darken her eyes. He rose and went behind her, where she sat at the little table. He put his hands upon her shoulders, marveling at the thickness and heaviness of his fingers upon the delicacy of her flesh and bone. She stiffened beneath his touch, and he made his hands go gently to the sides of her thin neck and let them brush into the fine reddish hair. Her neck was rigid, the cords vibrant in their tensity. He put his hands on her arms and lifted gently, so that she rose from the chair. He turned her to face him. Her eyes, wide and pale and nearly transparent in the candlelight, looked upon him blankly. He felt a distant closeness to her, and a pity for her helplessness. Desire thickened in his throat so that he could not speak. He pulled her a little toward the bedroom, feeling a quick, hard resistance in her body, and feeling at the same moment a willed putting away of the resistance. He left the door to the unlighted bedroom open. The candlelight glowed feebly in the darkness. He murmured as if to comfort and assure her, but his words were smothered, and he could not hear what he said. He put his hands upon her body and fumbled for the buttons that would open her to him. She pushed him away impersonally. In the dimness, her eyes were closed and her lips tight. She turned away from him and with a quick movement loosened her dress so that it fell crumpled about her feet. Her arms and shoulders were bare. She shuddered as if from cold, and said in a flat voice, "Go in the other room, I'll be ready in a minute." He touched her arms and put his lips to her shoulder, but she would not turn to him. In the sitting room he stared at the candles that flickered over the remains of their dinner, in the midst of which rested the bottle of champagne, still more than half full. He poured a little of the wine into a glass and tasted it. It had grown warm and sweetish. When he returned, Edith was in bed with the covers pulled to her chin, her face turned upward, her eyes closed, a thin frown creasing her forehead. Silently, as if she were asleep, Stoner undressed and got into bed beside her. For several moments he lay with his desire, which had become an impersonal thing, belonging to himself alone. He spoke to Edith, as if to find a haven for what he felt. She did not answer. He put his hand upon her and felt beneath the thin cloth of her nightgown the flesh he had longed for. He moved his hand upon her. She did not stir. Her frown deepened. Again he spoke, saying her name to silence. Then he moved his body upon her, gentle in his clumsiness. When he touched the softness of her thighs, she turned her head sharply away and lifted her arm to cover her eyes. She made no sound. Afterward he lay beside her and spoke to her in the quietness of his love. Her eyes were open then, and they stared at him out of the shadow. There was no expression on her face. Suddenly she flung the covers from her and crossed swiftly to the bathroom. He saw the light go on and heard her retch loudly and agonizingly. He called to her and went across the room. The door to the bathroom was locked. He called to her again. She did not answer. He went back to the bed and waited for her. After several minutes of silence, the light in the bathroom went off and the door opened. Edith came out and walked stiffly to the bed.
"It was the champagne," she said. "I shouldn't have had the second glass."
She pulled the covers over her and turned away from him. In a few moments her breathing was regular and heavy in sleep. Chapter 5. They returned to Columbia 2 days earlier than they had planned. Restless and strained by their isolation, it was as if they walked together in a prison. Edith said that they really ought to get back to Columbia so that William could prepare for his classes, and so that she could begin to get them settled in their new apartment. Stoner agreed at once, and told himself that things would be better once they were in a place of their own, among people they knew, and in surroundings that were familiar. They packed their belongings that afternoon, and were on the train to Columbia the same evening. In the hurried, vague days before their marriage, Stoner had found a vacant second-floor apartment in an old barn-like house 5 blocks from the university. It was dark and bare, with a small bedroom, a tiny kitchen, and a huge living room with high windows. It had at one time been occupied by an artist, a teacher at the university, who had been none too tidy. The dark, wide-planked floors were splotched with brilliant yellows and blues and reds, and the walls were smudged with paint and dirt. Stoner thought the place romantic and commodious, and he judged it to be a good place to start a new life. Edith moved into the apartment as if it were an enemy to be conquered. Though unused to physical labor, she scraped away most of the paint from the floors and walls and scrubbed at the dirt she imagined secreted everywhere. Her hands blistered, and her face became strained, with dark hollows beneath the eyes. When Stoner tried to help her, she became stubborn. Her lips tightened, and she shook her head. He needed the time for his studies, she said. This was her job. When he forced his help upon her, she became almost sullen, thinking herself to be humiliated. Puzzled and helpless, he withdrew his aid and watched, as grimly Edith continued awkwardly to scrub the gleaming floors and walls, to sew curtains and hang them unevenly from the high windows, to repair and paint and repaint the used furniture they had begun to accumulate. Though inept, she worked with a silent and intense ferocity, so that by the time William got home from the university in the afternoon, she was exhausted. She would drag herself to prepare the evening meal, eat a few bites, and then with a murmur vanish into the bedroom to sleep like one drugged until after William had left for his classes the next morning. Within a month he knew that his marriage was a failure. Within a year he stopped hoping that it would improve. He learned silence and did not insist upon his love. If he spoke to her or touched her in tenderness, she turned away from him within herself and became wordless, enduring, and for days afterward drove herself to new limits of exhaustion. Out of an unspoken stubbornness they both had, they shared the same bed. Sometimes at night in her sleep she unknowingly moved against him, and sometimes then his resolve and knowledge crumbled before his love, and he moved upon her. If she was sufficiently roused from her sleep, she tensed and stiffened, turning her head sideways in a familiar gesture, and burying it in her pillow, enduring violation. At such times Stoner performed his love as quickly as he could, hating himself for his haste and regretting his passion. Less frequently she remained half-numbed by sleep, then she was passive, and she murmured drowsily, whether in protest or surprise he did not know. He came to look forward to these rare and unpredictable moments, for in that sleep-drugged acquiescence he could pretend to himself that he found a kind of response. And he could not speak to her of what he took to be her unhappiness. When he attempted to do so, she accepted what he said as a reflection upon her adequacy and herself, and she became as morosely withdrawn from him as she did when he made love to her. He blamed his clumsiness for her withdrawal, and took upon himself the responsibility for what she felt. With a quiet ruthlessness that came from his desperation, he experimented with small ways of pleasing her. He brought her gifts, which she accepted indifferently, sometimes commenting mildly upon their expense. He took her on walks and picnics in the wooded countryside around Columbia, but she tired easily and sometimes became ill. He talked to her of his work, as he had done in their courtship, but her interest had become perfunctory and indulgent. At last, though he knew her to be shy, he insisted as gently as he could that they begin to entertain. They had an informal tea, to which a few of the younger instructors and assistant professors in the department were invited, and they gave several small dinner parties. In no way did Edith show whether she was pleased or displeased, but her preparations for the events were so frenzied and obsessive that by the time the guests arrived she was half hysterical from strain and weariness, though no one except William was really aware of this. She was a good hostess. She talked to her guests with an animation and ease that made her seem a stranger to William, and she spoke to him in their presence with an intimacy and fondness that always surprised him. She called him Willie, which touched him oddly, and sometimes she laid a soft hand upon his shoulder. But when the guests left, the facade fell upon itself and revealed her collapse. She spoke bitterly of the departed guests, imagining obscure insults and slights. She quietly and desperately recounted what she thought to be unforgivable failures of her own. She sat still and brooding in the litter the guests had left, and would not be roused by William, and would answer him briefly and distraughtly in a flat, monotonous voice. Only once had the facade cracked when guests were present. Several months after Stoner's and Edith's marriage, Gordon Finch had become engaged to a girl whom he had met casually while he was stationed in New York, and whose parents lived in Columbia. Finch had been given a permanent post as assistant dean, and it was tacitly understood that when Josiah Claremont died, Finch would be among the first to be considered for the deanship of the college. Somewhat belatedly, in celebration of both Finch's new position and the announcement of his engagement, Stoner asked him and his fiancée to dinner. They came just before dusk, on a warm evening in late May, in a shining black new touring car, which gave off a series of explosions as Finch expertly brought it to a halt on the brick road in front of Stoner's house. He honked the horn and waved gaily until William and Edith came downstairs. A small, dark girl with a round, smiling face sat beside him. He introduced her as Caroline Wingate, and the four of them talked for a moment while Finch helped her descend from the car.
"Well, how do you like it?"
Finch asked, thumping the front fender of the car with his closed fist.
"A beauty, isn't it? Belongs to Caroline's father. I'm thinking of getting one just like it, so..."
His voice trailed away and his eyes narrowed. He regarded the automobile speculatively and coolly, as if it were the future. Then he became lively and jocular again. With mock secrecy, he put his forefinger to his lips, looked furtively around, and took a large brown paper bag from the front seat of the car.
"Hooch," he whispered. "Just off the boat. Cover me, pal. Maybe we can make it to the house."
The dinner went well. Finch was more affable than Stoner had seen him in years. Stoner thought of himself and Finch and Dave Masters sitting together on those distant Friday afternoons after class, drinking beer and talking. The fiancée, Caroline, said little. She smiled happily as Finch joked and winked. It came to Stoner as an almost envious shock to realize that Finch was genuinely fond of this dark, pretty girl, and that her silence came from a rapt affection for him. Even Edith lost some of her strain and tenseness. She smiled easily, and her laughter was spontaneous. Finch was playful and familiar with Edith, in a way Stoner realized that he, her own husband, could never be, and Edith seemed happier than she had been in months. After dinner, Finch removed the brown paper bag from the icebox, where he had placed it earlier to cool, and took from it a number of dark brown bottles. It was a home brew that he made with great secrecy and ceremony in the closet of his bachelor apartment.
"No room for my clothes," he said, "but a man's got to keep his sense of values."
Carefully, with his eyes squinted, with the light glistening upon his fair skin and thinning blonde hair, like a chemist measuring a rare substance, he poured the beer from the bottles into glasses.
"Gotta be careful with this stuff," he said. "You get a lot of sediment at the bottom, and if you pour it off too quick, you get it in the glass."
They each drank a glass of the beer, complimenting Finch upon its taste. It was indeed surprisingly good, dry and light and of a good color. Even Edith finished her glass and took another. They became a little drunk. They laughed vaguely and sentimentally. They saw each other anew. Holding his glass up to the light, Stoner said, "I wonder how Dave would have liked this beer."
"Dave?"
Finch asked.
"Dave Masters. Remember how he used to love beer?" "Dave Masters," Finch said. "Good old Dave. It's a damned shame."
"Masters," Edith said. She was smiling fuzzily. "Wasn't he that friend of yours that was killed in the war?"
"Yes," Stoner said. "That's the one."
The old sadness came over him, but he smiled at Edith.
"Good old Dave," Finch said. "Edie, your husband and I and Dave used to really lap it up. Long before he knew of you, of course. Good old Dave."
They smiled at the memory of David Masters.
"He was a good friend of yours?" Edith asked.
Stoner nodded. "He was a good friend."
"Chateau Thierry."
Finch drained his glass.
"War's a hell of a thing." He shook his head. "But old Dave, he's probably somewhere laughing at us right now. He wouldn't be feeling sorry for himself. I wonder if he ever really got to see any of France."
"I don't know," Stoner said. "He was killed so soon after he got over."
"It'd be a shame if he didn't. I always thought that was one of the main reasons he joined up, to see some of Europe."
"Europe," Edith said distinctly.
"Yeah," Finch said. "Old Dave didn't want too many things, but he did want to see Europe before he died."
"I was going to Europe once," Edith said.
She was smiling, and her eyes glittered helplessly. "Do you remember, Willie? I was going with my Aunt Emma just before we got married. Do you remember?"
"I remember," Stoner said.
Edith laughed gratingly and shook her head as if she were puzzled. "That seems like a long time ago, but it wasn't. How long has it been, Willie?"
"Edith," Stoner said.
"Let's see, we were going in April, and then a year, and now it's May. I would have been..."
Suddenly her eyes filled with tears, though she was still smiling with a fixed brightness.
"I'll never get there now, I guess. Aunt Emma is going to die pretty soon, and I'll never have a chance to..."
Then, with the smile still tightening her lips and her eyes streaming with tears, she began to sob. Stoner and Finch rose from their chairs. "Edith," Stoner said helplessly.
"Oh, leave me alone!"
With a curious twisting motion, she stood erect before them, her eyes shut tight and her hands clenched at her sides.
"All of you, just leave me alone!"
And she turned and stumbled into the bedroom, slamming the door behind her. For a moment no one spoke. They listened to the muffled sound of Edith's sobbing. Then Stoner said, "You'll have to excuse her. She has been tired and not too well. The strain..."
"Sure I know how it is, Bill," Finch laughed hollowly. "Women and all. Guess I'll be getting used to it pretty soon myself."
He looked at Caroline, laughed again, and lowered his voice.
"Well, we won't disturb Edie right now. You just thank her for us. Tell her it was a fine meal, and you folks will have to come over to our place after we get settled in."
"Thanks, Gordon," Stoner said. "I'll tell her."
"And don't worry," Finch said. He punched Stoner on the arm. "These things happen."
After Gordon and Caroline had left, after he heard the new car roar and sputter away into the night, William Stoner stood in the middle of the living room and listened to Edith's dry and regular sobbing. It was a sound curiously flat and without emotion, and it went on as if it would never stop. He wanted to comfort her, he wanted to soothe her, but he did not know what to say. So he stood and listened, and after a while he realized that he had never before heard Edith cry. After the disastrous party with Gordon Finch and Caroline Wingate, Edith seemed almost contented, calmer than she had been at any time during their marriage. But she did not want to have anyone in, and she showed a reluctance to go outside the apartment. Stoner did most of their shopping, from lists that Edith made for him in a curiously laborious and childlike handwriting on little sheets of blue notepaper. She seemed happiest when she was alone. She would sit for hours working needlepoint or embroidering tablecloths and napkins, with a tiny, indrawn smile on her lips. Her Aunt Emma Darley began more and more frequently to visit her. When William came from the university in the afternoon, he often found the two of them together, drinking tea and conversing in tones so low that they might have been whispers. They always greeted him politely, but William knew that they saw him with regret. Mrs. Darley seldom stayed for more than a few minutes after he arrived. He learned to maintain an unobtrusive and delicate regard for the world in which Edith had begun to live. In the summer of 1920, he spent a week with his parents, while Edith visited her relatives in St. Louis. He had not seen his mother and father since the wedding. He worked in the fields for a day or two, helping his father and the Negro hired hand. But the give of the warm, moist clods beneath his feet and the smell of the new-turned earth in his nostrils evoked in him no feeling of return or familiarity. He came back to Columbia and spent the rest of the summer preparing for a new class that he was to teach the following academic year. He spent most of each day in the library, sometimes returning to Edith and the apartment late in the evening, through the heavy, sweet scent of honeysuckle that moved in the warm air and among the delicate leaves of dogwood trees that rustled and turned, ghost-like in the darkness. His eyes burned from their concentration upon dim texts. His mind was heavy with what it observed, and his fingers tingled numbly from the retained feel of old leather and board and paper. But he was open to the world through which for a moment he walked,
and he found some joy in it. A few new faces appeared at departmental meetings. Some familiar ones were not there, and Archer Sloane continued the slow decline which Stoner had begun to notice during the war. His hands shook, and he was unable to keep his attention upon what he said. The department went on with the momentum it had gathered through its tradition and the mere fact of its being. Stoner went about his teaching with an intensity and ferocity that awed some of the newer members of the department, and that caused a small concern among the colleagues who had known him for a longer time. His face grew haggard, he lost weight, and the stoop of his shoulders increased. In the second semester of that year, he had a chance to take a teaching overload for extra pay, and he took it. Also for extra pay, he taught in the new summer school that year. He had a vague notion of saving enough money to go abroad, so that he could show Edith the Europe she had given up for his sake. In the summer of 1921, searching for a reference to a Latin poem that he had forgotten, he glanced at his dissertation, for the first time since he had submitted it for approval 3 years earlier. He read it through and judged it to be sound. A little frightened at his presumption, he considered reworking it into a book. Though he was again teaching the full summer session, he reread most of the texts he had used and began to extend his research. Late in January, he decided that a book was possible. By early spring, he was far enough along to be able to write the first tentative pages. It was in the spring of the same year that calmly and almost indifferently, Edith told him that she had decided she wanted a child. The decision came suddenly and without apparent source, so that when she made the announcement one morning at breakfast, only a few minutes before William had to leave for his first class, she spoke almost with surprise, as if she had made a discovery. "What?" William said. "What did you say?" "I want a baby," Edith said. "I think I want to have a baby." She was nibbling a piece of toast. She wiped her lips with the corner of a napkin and smiled fixedly. "Don't you think we ought to have one?" she asked. "We've been married for nearly 3 years." "Of course," William said. He set his cup down in its saucer with great care. He did not look at her. "Are you sure? We've never talked about it. I wouldn't want you to—" "Oh, yes," she said, "I'm quite sure. I think we ought to have a child." William looked at his watch. "I'm late. I wish we had more time to talk. I want you to be sure." A small frown came between her eyes. "I told you I was sure. Don't you want one? Why do you keep asking me? I don't want to talk about it anymore." "All right," William said. He sat looking at her for a moment. "I've got to go." But he did not move. Then awkwardly he put his hand over her long fingers that rested on the tablecloth and kept it there until she moved her hand away. He got up from the table and edged around her, almost shyly, and gathered his books and papers. As she always did, Edith came into the living room to wait for him to leave. He kissed her on the cheek, something he had not done for a long while. At the door he turned and said, I'm glad you want a child, Edith. I know that in some ways our marriage has been a disappointment to you. I hope this will make a difference between us." "Yes," Edith said. "You'll be late for your class. You'd better hurry." After he had gone, Edith remained for some minutes in the center of the room, staring at the closed door, as if trying to remember something. Then she moved restlessly across the floor, walking from one place to another, moving within her clothing as if she could not endure its rustling and shifting upon her flesh. She unbuttoned her stiff gray taffeta morning robe and let it drop to the floor. She crossed her arms over her breasts and hugged herself, kneading the flesh of her upper arms through her thin flannel nightgown. Again she paused in her moving and walked purposefully into the tiny bedroom and opened a closet door, upon the inside of which hung a full-length mirror. She adjusted the mirror to the light and stood back from it, inspecting the long, thin figure and the straight blue nightgown that it reflected. Without removing her eyes from the mirror, she unbuttoned the top of her gown and pulled it up from her body and over her head, so that she stood naked in the morning light. She wadded the nightgown and threw it in the closet. Then she turned about before the mirror, inspecting the body as if it belonged to someone else. She passed her hands over her small drooping breasts, and let her hands go lightly down her long waist and over her flat belly. She moved away from the mirror and went to the bed, which was still unmade. She pulled the covers off, folded them carelessly, and put them in the closet. She smoothed the sheet on the bed and lay there on her back, her legs straight and her arms at her side. Unblinking and motionless, she stared up at the ceiling and waited through the morning and the long afternoon. When William Stoner got home that evening, it was nearly dark, but no light came from the second-floor windows. Vaguely apprehensive, he went up the stairs and flipped the living room light on. The room was empty. He called, "Edith?" There was no reply. He called again. He looked in the kitchen. The dishes from breakfast were still on the tiny table. He went swiftly across the living room and opened the door to the bedroom. Edith lay naked on the bare bed. When the door opened and the light from the living room fell upon her, she turned her head to him, but she did not get up. Her eyes were wide and staring, and little sounds came from her parted mouth. "Edith," he said, and went to where she lay, kneeling beside her. "Are you all right? What's the matter?" She did not answer, but the sounds she had been making became louder, and her body moved beside him. Suddenly her hands came out at him like claws, and he almost jerked away. But they went to his clothing, clutching and tearing at it, pulling him upon the bed beside her. Her mouth came up to him, gaping and hot. Her hands were going over him, pulling at his clothes, seeking him. And all the time her eyes were wide and staring and untroubled, as if they belonged to somebody else, and saw nothing. It was a new knowledge he had of Edith, this desire that was like a hunger so intense that it seemed to have nothing to do with herself. And no sooner was it sated than it began at once to grow again within her, so that they both lived in the tense expectation of its presence. Although the next 2 months were the only time of passion William and Edith Stoner ever had together, their relationship did not really change. Very soon Stoner realized that the force which drew their bodies together had little to do with love. They coupled with a fierce yet detached determination, drew apart and coupled again, without the strength to surfeit their need. Sometimes during the day, while William was at the university, the need came so strongly upon Edith that she could not remain still. She would leave the apartment and walk swiftly up and down the streets, going aimlessly from one place to another. And then she would return, draw closed the curtains of the windows, undress herself, and wait, crouched in the semi-darkness, for William to get home. And when he opened the door, she was upon him, her hands wild and demanding, as if they had a life of their own, pulling him toward the bedroom, upon the bed, which was still rumpled from their use of it the night or the morning before. Edith became pregnant in June, and immediately fell into an illness, from which she did not wholly recover during the full time of her waiting. Nearly at the moment she became pregnant, even before the fact was confirmed by her calendar and her physician, the hunger for William that had raged within her for the better part of 2 months ceased. She made it clear to her husband that she could not endure the touch of his hand upon her, and it began to seem to him that even his looking at her was a kind of violation. The hunger of their passion became a memory, and at last Stoner looked upon it as if it were a dream that had nothing to do with either of them. So the bed that had been the arena of their passion became the support of her illness. She kept to it most of the day, rising only to relieve her nausea in the morning, and to walk unsteadily about the living room for a few minutes in the afternoon. In the afternoon and evening, after he had hurried from his work at the university, William cleaned the rooms, washed the dishes, and made the evening meal. He carried Edith's dinner to her on a tray. Though she did not want him to eat with her, She did seem to enjoy sharing a cup of weak tea with him after dinner. For a few moments in the evening, then, they talked quietly and casually, as if they were old friends or exhausted enemies. Edith would fall asleep soon afterward, and William would return to the kitchen, complete the housework, and then set up a table before the living-room sofa, where he would grade papers or prepare lectures. Then, past midnight, he would cover himself with a blanket he kept neatly folded behind the couch, and with his length curled up on the couch, he would sleep fitfully until morning. The child, a girl, was born after a 3-day period of labor in the middle of March in the year 1923. They named her Grace, after one of Edith's aunts who had died many years before. Even at birth, Grace was a beautiful child, with distinct features and a light down of golden hair. Within a few days, the first redness of her skin turned into a glowing golden pink. She seldom cried, and she seemed almost aware of her surroundings. William fell instantly in love with her. The affection he could not show to Edith, he could show to his daughter, and he found a pleasure in caring for her that he had not anticipated. For nearly a year after the birth of Grace, Edith remained partly bedridden. There was some fear that she might become a permanent invalid, though the doctor could find no specific trouble. William hired a woman to come in during the morning to care for Edith, and he arranged his classes so that he would be at home early in the afternoon. Thus, for more than a year, William kept the house and cared for two helpless people. He was up before dawn, grading papers and preparing lectures. Before going to the university, he fed Grace, prepared breakfast for himself and Edith, and fixed a lunch for himself, which he took to school in his briefcase. After his classes, he came back to the apartment, which he swept, dusted, and cleaned. And he was more nearly a mother than a father to his daughter. He changed her diapers and washed them. He chose her clothing and mended it when it was torn. He fed her and bathed her and rocked her in his arms when she was distressed. Every now and then, Edith would call querulously for her baby. William would bring Grace to her, and Edith, propped up in bed, would hold her for a few moments, silently and uncomfortably, as if the child belonged to someone else who was a stranger. Then she would tire, and with a sigh, hand the baby back to William. Moved by some obscure emotion, she would weep a little, dab at her eyes, and turn away from him. So, for the first year of her life, Grace Stoner knew only her father's touch, and his voice, and his love. Chapter 6. Early in the summer of 1924, on a Friday afternoon, Archer Sloane was seen by several students going into his office. He was discovered shortly after dawn the following Monday by a janitor who made the rounds of the offices in Jesse Hall to empty the waste baskets. Sloane was sitting rigidly, slumped in his chair before his desk, his head at an odd angle, his eyes open and fixed in a terrible stare. The janitor spoke to him and then ran shouting through the empty halls. There was some delay in the removal of the body from the office, and a few early students were milling in the corridors when the curiously humped and sheeted figure was carried on a stretcher down the steps to the waiting ambulance. It was later determined that Sloane had died sometime late Friday night or early Saturday morning, of causes that were obviously natural but never precisely determined, and had remained the whole weekend at the desk, staring endlessly before him. The coroner announced heart failure as the cause of death, but William Stoner always felt that in a moment of anger and despair, Sloane had willed his heart to cease, as if in a last mute gesture of love and contempt for a world that had betrayed him so profoundly that he could not endure in it. Stoner was one of the pallbearers at the funeral. At the services, he could not keep his mind on the words the minister said, but he knew that they were empty. He remembered Sloane as he had first seen him in the classroom. He remembered their first talks together, and he thought of the slow decline of this man who had been his distant friend. Later, after the services were over, when he lifted his handle of the gray casket and helped to carry it out to the hearse, what he carried seemed so light that he could not believe there was anything inside the narrow box. Sloane had no family, only his colleagues and a few people from town gathered around the narrow pit and listened in awe, embarrassment, and respect as the minister said his words. And because he had no family or loved ones to mourn his passing, it was Stoner who wept when the casket was lowered, as if that weeping might reduce the loneliness of the last descent. Whether he wept for himself, for the part of his history and youth that went down to the earth, or whether for the poor thin figure that once kept the man he had loved, he did not know. Gordon Finch drove him back to town, and for most of the ride they did not speak. Then when they neared town, Gordon asked about Edith. William said something and inquired after Caroline. Gordon replied, and there was a long silence. Just before they drove up to William's apartment, Gordon Finch spoke again.
"I don't know. All during the service I kept thinking about Dave Masters, about Dave dying in France, and about old Sloane sitting there at his desk, dead 2 days, like they were the same kinds of dying. I never knew Sloane very well, but I guess he was a good man. At least I hear he used to be. And now we'll have to bring somebody else in and find a new chairman for the department. It's like it all just goes around and around and keeps on going. It makes you wonder."
"Yes," William said, and did not speak further. But he was for a moment very fond of Gordon Finch, and when he got out of the car and watched Gordon drive away, he felt the keen knowledge that another part of himself, of his past, was drawing slowly, almost imperceptibly away from him, into the darkness. In addition to his duties as assistant dean, Gordon Finch was given the interim chairmanship of the English department, and it became his immediate duty to find a replacement for Archer Sloane. It was July before the matter was settled. Then Finch called those members of the department who had remained in Columbia over the summer and announced the replacement. It was, Finch told the little group, a 19th-century specialist, Hollis N. Lomax, who had recently received his Ph.D. from Harvard University, but who had nevertheless taught for several years at a small downstate New York liberal arts college. He came with high recommendations, he had already started publishing, and he was being hired at the assistant professor level. There were, Finch emphasized, no present plans about the departmental chairmanship. Finch was to remain interim chairman for at least one more year. For the rest of the summer, Lomax remained a figure of mystery and the object of speculation by the permanent members of the faculty. The essays that he had published in the journals were dug out, read, and passed around with judicious nods. Lomax did not make his appearance during New Student Week, nor was he present at the general faculty meeting on the Friday before Monday student registration. And at registration, the members of the department, sitting in a line behind the long desks, wearily helping students choose their classes and assisting them in the deadly routine of filling out forms, looked surreptitiously around for a new face. Still, Lomax did not make an appearance. He was not seen until the departmental meeting late Tuesday afternoon, after registration had been completed. By that time, numbed by the monotony of the last 2 days, and yet tense with the excitement that begins a new school year, the English faculty had nearly forgotten about Lomax. They sprawled in desk-top chairs in a large lecture room in the east wing of Jesse Hall, and looked up with contemptuous yet eager expectancy at the podium, where Gordon Finch stood surveying them with massive benevolence. A low hum of voices filled the room. Chairs scraped on the floor. Now and then someone laughed, deliberately, raucously. Gordon Finch raised his right hand and held it palm outward to his audience. The hum quieted a little. It quieted enough for everyone in the room to hear the door at the rear of the hall creak open and to hear a distinctive, slow shuffle of feet on the bare wood floor. They turned, and the hum of their conversation died. Someone whispered, "It's Lomax," and the sound was sharp and audible through the room. He had come through the door, closed it, and had advanced a few steps beyond the threshold where he now stood. He was a man barely over 5 feet in height, and his body was grotesquely misshapen. A small hump raised his left shoulder to his neck, and his left arm hung laxly at his side. His upper body was heavy and curved, so that he appeared to be always struggling for balance. His legs were thin, and he walked with a hitch in his stiff right leg. For several moments he stood with his blond head bent downward, as if he were inspecting his highly polished black shoes and the sharp crease of his black trousers. Then he lifted his head and shot his right arm out, exposing a stiff white length of cuff with gold links. There was a cigarette in his long pale fingers. He took a deep drag, inhaled, and expelled the smoke in a thin stream. And then they could see his face. It was the face of a matinee idol. Long and thin and mobile, it was nevertheless strongly featured. His forehead was high and narrow, with heavy veins, and his thick waving hair, the color of ripe wheat, swept back from it in a somewhat theatrical pompadour. He dropped his cigarette on the floor, ground it beneath his sole, and spoke.
"I am Lomax."
He paused. His voice, rich and deep, articulated his words precisely with a dramatic resonance.
"I hope I have not disrupted your meeting."
The meeting went on, but no one paid much attention to what Gordon Finch said. Lomax sat alone in the back of the room, smoking and looking at the high ceiling, apparently oblivious of the heads that turned now and then to look at him. After the meeting was over, he remained in his chair and let his colleagues come up to him, introduce themselves, and say what they had to say. He greeted each of them briefly with a courtesy that was oddly mocking. During the next few weeks, it became evident that Lomax did not intend to fit himself into the social, cultural, and academic routine of Columbia, Missouri. Though he was ironically pleasant to his colleagues, he neither accepted nor extended any social invitations. He did not even attend the annual open house at Dean Claremont's, though the event was so traditional that attendance was almost obligatory. He was seen at none of the university concerts or lectures. It was said that his classes were lively and that his classroom behavior was eccentric. He was a popular teacher. Students clustered around his desk during his off hours, and they followed him in the halls. It was known that he occasionally invited groups of students to his rooms, where he entertained them with conversation and recordings of string quartets. William Stoner wished to know him better, but he did not know how to do so. He spoke to him when he had something to say, and he invited him to dinner. When Lomax answered him, as he did everyone else, ironically polite and impersonal, and when he refused the invitation to dinner, Stoner could think of nothing else to do. It was some time before Stoner recognized the source of his attraction to Hollis Lomax. In Lomax's arrogance, his fluency, and his cheerful bitterness, Stoner saw, distorted but recognizable, an image of his friend David Masters. He wished to talk to him as he had talked to Dave, but he could not, even after he admitted his wish to himself. The awkwardness of his youth had not left him, but the eagerness and straightforwardness that might have made the friendship possible had. He knew what he wished was impossible, and the knowledge saddened him. In the evenings, after he had cleaned the apartment, washed the dinner dishes, and put Grace to bed in a crib set in a corner of a living room, he worked on the revision of his book. By the end of the year it was finished, and though he was not altogether pleased with it, he sent it to a publisher. To his surprise, the study was accepted and scheduled for publication in the fall of 1925. On the strength of the unpublished book, he was promoted to assistant professor.